You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 15th of May, 2024, on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. It's 1400 in Singapore, 8am in Copenhagen, 7am here in London and 2am in Washington DC. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Globalist starts now. Hello, this is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, huge unrest in Georgia as the parliament passes what demonstrators call the Russia law. We'll have the latest from the streets of Tbilisi. Singapore has a new prime minister today. We'll look at how that came about, who he is, and how it might impact one of the world's major financial hubs. Ursula von der Leyen is on the campaign trail ahead of the EU elections. She was speaking at the Copenhagen Democracy Summit. We'll hear more about the event, its aims, and what it's achieved so far. Then,
the fact that a number of these places are organized, we're trying to think through how do we make sure they stay magnetic and create different kinds of programs to pull people back in.
We'll gain some understanding of what innovation districts are and how they can help cities. We'll flick through the papers, get a hit of business news, and finally, has Hallyu gone to hell in a handbasket? As a huge hullabaloo erupts amongst some of the leaders in the K-pop industry, how will it affect South Korea's cultural capital. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he backs China's plan for a peaceful settlement of the Ukraine crisis, adding that Beijing has a full understanding of what lies behind the situation. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken paid a surprise visit to Kyiv yesterday and said America will stand by Ukraine until its security sovereignty is guaranteed. And Israeli tanks pushed deeper into Rafah on Tuesday, reaching some residential areas of the southern Gazan border city and pounding the enclave's north in some of the fiercest attacks in months. Do stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, Georgia's controversial foreign agents bill was passed in the third and final reading in Parliament yesterday, despite huge protests in the capital, Tbilisi. The demonstrators have described the bill as Russia's law and are concerned that it will mean that the country will not be integrated into the European Union. The bloc itself says the law is incompatible with EU values. Police used tear gas against the crowds and there was even violence in the chamber. Well, I'm joined now by Giorgi Tabagari, who's founder of Tbilisi Pride and a civic activist. Giorgi, many thanks for coming on the show. Now, we've been reporting this story for some time, and as we've seen, these protests have been ongoing for weeks, and they're some of the biggest demonstrations seen in Georgia since it regained independence from Moscow back in 1991. I wonder if you can describe to us what's been going on the streets.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. Basically, people are out on the streets to protect the country. The sense of urgency is quite felt all over the place. The generations understand that just 35 years of independence might just go to waste if we lose this the fight against the Kremlin puppet government that Georgia is having now. They are trying to derail from the declared pro-European path, which has been actually embodied in the Georgia's constitution as well. By adoption, this Russian bill, which pretty much identifies everyone from the civil society organizations who is getting foreign funding as foreign agents after the bill is enforced. It kills off the very foundation of Georgia's democracy, and people have a very strong understanding of the processes that are happening, because all of this have already took place in Russia back in the time when this the bill started working in 2012. So all of this are present in the mind of the protesters, and this is why the consecutively so many days people are on the streets, and they will continue to do so until the bill is withdrawn or the government has resigned.
Because the bill actually was postponed once before. I mean, there's a precedent for the people actually being able to interfere in this process.
Yes, indeed. Last year, they had the first attempt to pass this bill. And after they had to withdraw after the mass protests last year, very unexpectedly, they put back this bill again on the agenda earlier in April. Just to give a context to also the listeners, this is basically not only happening in Georgia, but in many other places where Russia is usually strongly present or is intending to be strongly present. The same is happening in Abkhazia, which is occupied by Russia. Like, the bill is proposed simultaneously there. Kyrgyzstan, Bosnia, they are trying to sabotage the pro-Western government in Armenia now. This is all happening together with fighting the actual war in Ukraine. So all of this is happening simultaneously, basically, in this former Soviet space. And unfortunately, Georgia is one of them as well.
And is that done out of fear? Are people afraid that Russia will invade as it has done in Ukraine?
They don't need to invade, because in Ukraine, Ukraine had the pro-Western government, and as you remember, there was Maidan years ago, which costed the Putin's puppet to leave the government. In our case, unfortunately, in 2012, when the government changed, they slowly showed their faces, and now no one is doubting that this government is inclining to the Kremlin direction. And so they don't need to go into the military battle, because they already have people who are putting forward Russia's interests in the government. So at the moment, I don't expect any military engagement from the Russian side. But if the process will evolve as it happened in Ukraine, basically what I'm trying to say is that a lot of things depend on how things will go in Ukraine. If Ukraine falls, everyone has an understanding that Georgia, Armenia, and all of these small countries will fall, because basically we are in this together.
So Georgian Dream, the party behind this, says it's not against Europe. But of course, as you say, it's accused of unwinding all of the progress made since the Rose Revolution back in 2003. Who is Bidzina Ivanishvili, who it seems to be the man driving this big oligarch?
Yes. Bidzina Ivanishvili is this self-oriented person who he has been behind Georgian Dream ever since they came into power. He's a billionaire. He found his fortune in Russia. He had dual citizenship, Russian, like French and Georgian. And basically, when they came into power, he moved into the shadows, and he's managing the government without being actually responsible for anything, which makes it things a little more complicated. And he's closely connected to Kremlin. There are several recordings, audio recordings, and different information about how he is closely in touch with Kremlin-affiliated people. And there are like a couple of facts which everyone knows that happened since 2012. For instance, like, not a single Russian spy has been identified ever since Georgian Dream came into power, which is very strange if you look at the geographical location and how Russia operates in general. They haven't allowed a lot of critical voices from Russia when there was this mass movement from Moscow to Georgia. And usually there hasn't been any single critical statement which involves Putin and Russia made by this man. So whether he is connected with Kremlin out of fear, or this is just a special operation that usually Russia does in the neighborhood, I don't know exactly. Obviously, we can speculate. But the thing that he is closely connected to Kremlin and putting forward the laws, which is only endorsed and liked by Kremlin-affiliated people at the moment, and everyone else, the EU countries, the European Union institutions, and the US, everyone is warning Georgia this will drift away the country from the European integration path. They still adopted it with a third hearing. So at this point, we are not really doubting what are the motives and intentions of Bidzina Ivanishvili.
But the draft now has to go to President Salome Zurabishvili. She said that she will veto it. So what happens then?
Lately, since Salome Zurabishvili became more and more vocal about the policies of Georgian government, she's been vetoing a lot of different bills. And a couple of bills have been very harmful that has been vetoed by the president. And usually what they do is that the majority in the parliament is overruling the veto. We are still hoping that the protests and the backlash that they are getting from the society is going to affect, and they might just not overrule the veto this time. But this is we don't know, obviously, until that happens, how things develop, because things are changing every day, and everything is like very volatile at this point in Georgia.
You've talked about the international reactions. The US is considering sanctions. The EU, of course, very, very concerned about this. What about the people who are directly affected by the law, NGOs, some media organizations and so on? Will they be registering as the law says they must?
They say no one is planning to register. This is coming from the critical independent organizations that are usually not, I mean, who are usually getting the funds from different foundations. But there are also like GONGOs that we call this, the government led civil society that might just register. But generally, like, who is going to take the status of the foreign agent? This is madness. No one is going to like voluntarily register themselves as a foreign agent in some sort of a database. So that's why even if the law is passed, people who are behind these organizations and they are saying very openly that they're not intending to register themselves as foreign agents. We've seen how this went in Russia. Even singers and public figures from the Russian society are now named as foreign agents, and they have to declare it that way, because over the course of 10 years in Russia, the law became an oppressive document which doesn't leave any room for democracy and fundamental rights, which was so far the case in Georgia.
Georgi, thank you very much indeed. That's Georgi Tabagari speaking to us from Tbilisi, and this is The Globalist. Coming up to 13 minutes past 1400 in Singapore, that's 7:14 here in London. Well, in Singapore, the former Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister, Lawrence Wong, has been sworn in as the country's new Prime Minister today. This comes after Lee Hsien Loong stepped down from the position after nearly 20 years in power, handing to his deputy in what's only the third leadership transition in the Asian financial hub's modern history. Well, I'm joined now by James Chambers, Monocle's Asia editor. James, good morning to you, and thanks for coming on. Why did the Prime Minister step down?
I should mention, Georgina, it hasn't actually happened yet. It's happening this evening in Singapore, which is slightly odd to have such a transition happen at night, but it will be happening today, and it'll be a huge day for Singapore because, as you mentioned, the current Prime Minister, Lee Hsien Loong, has been in the job for 20 years. But he has been signalling that he wants it to hand over power. He is 72. Way back in 2012, he said that he wanted to resign by the time he turned 70. That would have been in 2022, but a little thing called COVID came along, and that delayed things somewhat. So this is a transition, a handover of power that's long been in the works, but still. After being in the job for 20 years, it's still a very big day for Singapore.
So what can you tell us about the new man? What is Lee Wong's background? Lawrence Wong, I beg your pardon.
Lawrence Wong, I mean, he's young, he's 51. He He's an economist. He was a civil servant for a long time and then entered parliament in 2011. He wasn't the first choice to succeed Prime Minister Lee, but he does, you know, seem to be very well liked. He's a man of the people, unlike some of his predecessors as prime minister. He grew up in a very modest, humble background, like most people in Singapore. He grew up in a public housing estate. His father was born in China and, you know, came to Singapore. And so he does have this kind of down-to-earth man of the people reputation, not one of the elite. And you can see that in the way that he has been communicating with the people so far. One of his biggest jobs, high-profile jobs, was leading the kind of COVID task force. And so he did these regular press conferences. And that's something that he obviously wants to continue. When he took to the airwaves on Monday to announce his cabinet, you know, he did say that there will be a lot more press conferences. And he kind of does want to improve the communication between the Prime Minister and the public. So I guess the message there he's going to be a lot more accessible and a lot more open.
Mm. And so what do you think that means for Singapore?
Well, I think the fact that Prime Minister Lee has decided to hand over now, before the next election, which must happen by November next year, is a signal that the people in charge of the People's Action Party, which is the party that has always ruled Singapore since independence, are confident that Lawrence Wong has proved himself and he is the man who can lead the party into the next election. Because there was this, Prime Minister Lee did make it clear that, you know, he may stay on to lead the party until the next election and then hand over. So the fact that he has decided to go now means that he does have confidence that Lawrence Wong can lead the party into the next election and can kind of keep the PAP in power. So, you know, as we look ahead, that is going to be the most immediate test for Mr. Wong. And we won't have much time to wait until we see whether he is a popular choice in Singapore. Because right now, it is important to note, this transition is very much within the party. This is the PAP deciding to hand the job from one of their people to another. The people of Singapore haven't had a say in this yet, and we'll have to wait until the next election to see what they think.
Mm. And James, finally, Singapore is obviously a huge financial hub. Has this affected the markets at all?
You know, this has been a transition that's been long in the making, and also Prime Minister Lee signalled last month the exact date of when he would step down. So everyone's kind of priced this in. Everyone knew this was going to happen. You know, obviously there will be a bit of you know, everyone will be keen to see how Mr. Wong handles it. But it's not like he's going to be handed the reins and having to do it all himself. Prime Minister Lee is continuing on as a senior minister, so he will still be very much in the room and advising Lawrence Wong on how to manage Singapore. So on that front, I wouldn't think the markets would be too worried. But of course, it comes at a very difficult time for global relations. Singapore has this very unique role at being a country and an advisor that's trusted by both Beijing and Washington. It's seen as, you know, the kind of the middleman that can speak to both of those superpowers. So that'll be perhaps one of his other big challenges on the international front, to see if he can kind of keep the peace in a way and continue Singapore's role as the kind of mediator, the Switzerland of Asia.
James, thank you very much indeed. That's James Chambers there. Now, still to come on the programme. I'm super shy, but wait a minute while I make you mine, make you mine. Controversy rocks the world of K-pop. We'll have the latest. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Well, Well, let's continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me in the studio is political journalist and author Terry Stiastny. Good morning to you, Terry.
Good morning.
Now, controversy may well be rocking the world of K-pop, but why is Neil Young suddenly making the headlines in Kyiv?
Well, yes, Neil Young, courtesy of Antony Blinken, who after his obviously more serious discussions in Kyiv, where he was talking about air defence and talking about the US aid package for Ukraine, decided to go to a bar after he'd had an evening where he gave a big speech talking about Ukrainian courage. And he went to a bar, apparently called Barman Diktat, a speakeasy-style bar in central Kyiv, The Guardian is reporting here. And he joined the band, Ukrainian band 1999, on stage, and he played Neil Young's song, Rockin' in the Free World, and he's playing this sort of red electric guitar, and it's, you know, if you listen to it, it's clearly not very rehearsed. It's clearly they're all trying to pick it up, and he doesn't actually play for very long. But I think, you know, interesting that he chooses there to go and sort of play in a band and go and say, you know, we're fighting not just for a free Ukraine, but for the free world, and the free world is with you too. And there's been a little bit of criticism of him for doing that, but I think generally it's the kind of thing that will probably come across quite well. I mean, yeah, it was clear that they weren't all entirely playing the same song at the same time. But I want to know, does he bring his own guitar? You know, if he's Antony Blinken, he's travelling around the world. Is he travelling with a guitar and an amp, just ready to jump in and, you know, jam with a band wherever he finds one?
Let's talk about what the sort of serious side of the visit, because he has promised that long-awaited $60 billion of Ukraine aid will make a real difference. And he's really pushing for it to come. It was a very reassuring visit at a time where Kyiv is really on the back foot here.
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, looking at, you know, the Russian offensive going on, I mean, he was saying that, you know, this is a challenging time, that the help was coming, some of it had arrived, or more of it would be arriving soon, and saying that this was going to make a real difference. So I think, yeah, really what this visit was about was trying to provide reassurance, trying to say that, you know, we are still with you, we are helping you, and, you know, trying to be more positive. It was described here in this speech at the University of trying to inject an air of positivity about the future.
Mm. And just looking at what is happening in Kharkiv, the Russian offensive there risks putting that second city back in Russian artillery range for the first time since 2022.
Yes, it does seem to be very closely fought. Russia has been seizing some villages in recent days. They're trying to move towards another town, Vovchansk, and they're saying this could be the first town that, if once it had been already liberated by the Ukrainians, then it could be reoccupied by the Russians. So obviously people are extremely worried about this, and that, you know, the time is absolutely of the essence here.
Mm. This article goes on to point out something that I think the world is worried about. It's talking about David Lammy, who of course was there too. It says that he talks about British support for Ukraine reaches across the parties, but of course that's not the case in the US, and we know that aid was held up largely because of Donald Trump and his supporters. And people are extremely worried about what a change of president will mean.
Well, yes, I mean, exactly. Because I think, you know, although this is a message of reassurance from the current government, and they want to get the aid and the support for Ukraine there as quickly as possible, obviously, you know, come November, if there was a change of government, that could change really quickly. And, you know, I'm sure Zelensky and his colleagues are, you know, concerned about that, and they're trying to keep up the pressure on the US as well from their side, and sort of say this is really vitally important for them.
Let's go to the Middle East now, and we're picking up on this FT story about the US encouraging Arab states to join a multinational post-war force in Gaza.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting story in the Financial Times, and it's not one that I've seen elsewhere yet. And it does sound like something that is a long way off, but it's just an idea of the way people are thinking at the moment. So there is a suggestion that the Biden administration is trying to get Arab states to join into a peacekeeping force in Gaza at some point in the future. They've been talking to Egypt, the UAE and Morocco about this. But I mean, there's obviously lots of problems potentially with this. But so one of them is the Arab states have said, we would like the US to lead this, but the US doesn't want to actually go and send troops into Gaza. So how do you lead a peacekeeping force if you don't actually have boots on the ground? I mean, another issue is the conditions that the Arab states would want to put on this. They say the US would have to recognise a Palestinian state before they form some kind of an international force. And there are other states like Saudi Arabia, which in this report said doesn't want to do this because their fear that they'll be seen to be co- complicit in Israel. So this is in a kind of an interesting long-term idea, Washington trying to get momentum for a stability force. But, you know, there's so many questions between here and there as to how this might possibly work out.
Of course, because as part of the process, they want Gaza to be administered by a reformed Palestinian leadership. So that the PA that governs the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem is very weak. And of course, so who takes that leadership is a key point.
Well, absolutely. How do you reform the leadership? And also, you know, the other big question, of course, is how do you get Israel to agree to this? You know, would Israel be, even with a reformed Palestinian leadership, be willing to see troops from other Arab states in Gaza? You know, is this and under what framework? You know, it doesn't seem to be any kind of discussion about the UN doing this. But, you know, how do you organise it? How do you structure it? And, you know, obviously, given the history of peacekeeping missions in the region in the past, those have been really difficult.
Now, I love this story. It's about the Dublin portal to New York. First of all, tell us what that is.
I love this as well.
Tell us about the problem.
It's a bit of a lesson to us all here. So there was a portal which is designed to be a tourist attraction. So it's an image of this here from the Irish Times in Dublin, which is set up in a street in Dublin, North Earl Street. And it's a big sort of a big screen, a big round screen, where if you're standing in Dublin, you can look into the portal and see people in New York and vice versa. If you're standing in New York, you can have a look and see what's going on in Dublin. And of course, this is not surprisingly run into problems because people cannot be trusted to have nice things. And so obviously everybody does not just want to wave nicely and say, hello, New York, or hello, Dublin. They've decided to display their bits to the camera. They have decided to show all sorts of nasty images, people even showing things like really bad taste, like images of 9/11. Some people are, you know, using it in the way that it was meant to. But they were trying to blur some of the images so that if you were showing, you know, indiscreet things to the other side of the Atlantic, that would be blurred and you couldn't see it. But they, because this is not working, they have had to come and switch it off for the time being and say some, you know, essentially the line is Dublin City Council saying, listen, a few people are spoiling this for everybody. And if you can't all behave, you will not be allowed to have the portal. But apparently, you know, this is a global phenomenon, the Dublin portal, and they are hoping to switch it back on later in the week.
Play nicely is this. Yeah. The subtext, yeah. And finally, what do we think of King Charles's first official portrait? Do you want to describe
yes,
the portrait?
Yes, I have to do
to
a radio it's version of the portrait. This is a really interesting portrait. So it's the first official portrait of Charles as the new king, which the artist Jonathan Yeo started working on before he was king, when he was still Prince of Wales. And to describe it, it's a kind of Charles sort of emerging. You can see his face very clearly, and he's got this slightly sort of sardonic, sort of wistful look on him. But he's in a red uniform, which is the uniform of the Welsh Guards, but he's very much against a red background, and he sort of blurs into the background. So I'm not sure if he's kind of emerging or retreating. And one of the things is you see a butterfly on his shoulder, which I think is supposed to be something to do with kind of nature and metamorphosis.
And it's a monarch butterfly.
It's a monarch butterfly as well. So I think the picture is kind of growing on me. I don't know why. I first thought, oh, well, that you can barely see him. And actually, the more you look at it, I think the more interesting that it is. But I think one of the worries about it maybe is, okay, if it's a butterfly, it's a symbol of transition, and he has kind of emerged as king, like maybe out of his cocoon. But it also suggests that it's quite ephemeral, and that he might sort of fade back into the background again. So yeah. I think it's a really interesting picture. I'm not sure if, you know, the symbolism of it is what you would necessarily want if you were the king.
It's and I mean, one of the things that it's achieved is because he blurs into the background. It has hidden his ears, which quite a notable feature.
Yes, yeah. But it's going to be in the Draper's Hall, and it's going to be on public display.
And the red itself, I mean, Twitter certainly is describing it as menstrual.
I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, that would not necessarily be a connotation you would want. And it's Charles's hands are one of the others. You sort of see his face, and you can see his hands very clearly.
His sausage fingers, as they're described by him, I think.
Yes, and I think one of the diplomatic things that the king said when it was unveiled, he said, "Oh, yes, it's very red, isn't it?"
It certainly is very red. Terry, thank you very much indeed. That's Terry Stiastny there. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he backs China's plan for a peaceful settlement of the Ukraine crisis, adding that Beijing has a full understanding of what lies behind the situation. Putin was speaking to China's state news agency ahead of his visit to Beijing this week. Beijing put forward a 12-point paper more than a year ago that set out general principles for ending the war and received a lukewarm reception at the time. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken paid a surprise visit to Kyiv yesterday and said America will stand by Ukraine until its security sovereignty is guaranteed. Russia is mounting fresh attacks in the country's east and now controls about 18% of Ukraine, gaining ground since the failure of Kyiv's 2023 counteroffensive. And Israeli tanks pushed deeper into Rafah on Tuesday, reaching some residential areas of the southern Gazan border city, where more than a million people have sought shelter, and its forces pounded the enclave's north in some of the fiercest attacks in months. With fighting intensifying, Qatar's prime minister said ceasefire talks between Israel and Hamas, mediated by his country and Egypt, are at a stalemate. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. The 7th annual Copenhagen Democracy Summit, which began yesterday, wraps up today at the Royal Danish Playhouse. Founded and chaired by Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the event seeks to bring democratic forces closer together to counter increasingly aggressive autocratic regimes. Suzanne Lynch is Global Playbook author and associate editor at Politico Brussels, and she's there. Suzanne, you ricochet between these various global conferences. How does this one measure up? What makes it different?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because of this focus on democracy per se. I mean, what you see at a lot of other conferences, for example, the World Economic Forum at Davos is one example, you would see a presence from Saudi Arabia, China, countries that don't have democracies. They are very much present, or the representatives are, at these international events. Here, they like to say, as they put it, a dictator-free zone. It's about talking to countries and leaders about democracy, about the power of democracy as a force, as a guiding light of political governance. They do have some dissidents from countries like Iran. They've got a big presence from Taiwan, for example, here, but no China. So I think that will be one of the kind of distinctive factors of this conference that's, as you say, finishing up here today.
So before the conference started, you sat down with Anders Fogh Rasmussen, as well as founder and chair of the event. He's also the former Danish Prime Minister and NATO chief. He started with some good news. Tell us what he had to say.
Yeah, they have done a very wide-ranging survey. More than 60,000 people were surveyed for their democracy perception index. And it found that most people still value democracy, no matter what country you live in, even if you live in a more of an autocratic state, that democracy is seen as, you know, the most viable kind of political system. So he sees that as a positive. However, there were some interesting findings too. It found a big disparity, and this is becoming a big issue, I think, for the West, between how Europe and the US views Russia and the rest of the world views Russia. So since the invasion, the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, which is now well over 2 years ago, we've seen the US and the EU sever ties, essentially, with Moscow impose sanctions. And this survey showed that most of the rest of the world, people don't want to do that. They want to maintain ties with Russia. So this is highlighting a problem that the international community faces now, and that Zelensky and the Ukrainian leadership faces, how to get the rest of the world, the so-called global south, on board and to ensure it's very much on Ukraine's side in this war against Russia.
And what was Rasmussen's take on Ukraine's NATO membership?
Yeah, so this is going to be a big topic over the next few months. We've got the NATO summit coming up in July in Washington, D.C. And Rasmussen, who's been working with the Zelensky government on a possible peace plan, has also strongly come out. They've issued another report here calling for NATO membership for Ukraine. Now, this is obviously a contentious, controversial issue. It's not something Russia wants. But he makes the point that, you know, that Ukraine's future is with the Western Euro-US alliance, and that you need to include Ukraine in NATO. If there's an argument that you cannot allow a country that's at war to join NATO, he says, well, that's only going to perpetuate the war. That's going to give more reason for Putin, perversely, to keep going with the war if he knows that if Ukraine remains at war, it won't join NATO. That's his argument. Now, he's saying that they won't join, you know, tomorrow, that there will be a process. But at the very least, at the July summit in Washington, D.C., that accession negotiations should be offered, should start with Ukraine at that summit.
Mm. Now, Ursula von der Leyen is there, but interestingly, not as European Commission chief. Tell us more about what she said.
Yeah, that's interesting because, I mean, we're only a few weeks away from the European Parliament elections, a big moment in European politics. And Ursula von der Leyen herself is effectively campaigning. She wants to have another 5 years at the top of the European Commission. So she was a very late addition to the schedule here. But she did arrive and she was doing some other campaigning here in Denmark, too. Now, she was came out with a very strong call saying that if she is re-elected for another 5 years, that she would introduce what's called, she's calling a European democracy shield. And that's about trying to counter disinformation in election years in particular. It's a very, very big focus at this summit. We're hearing from people from Taiwan, people in the US and people in Europe about efforts, about misinformation, about, you know, viral videos and electoral disinformation that is penetrating, particularly on social media, ahead of elections in established democracies. So von der Leyen promising there that if she gets in for another 5 years, that this was is going to be a priority for the next European Commission.
Mm. Have there been any significant announcements so far?
Well, I think the Ukraine piece is the biggest. This report that came out, Zelensky's top advisor, Yermak, has been here. We also heard from the Ukrainian defense minister remotely. And I think that this report that was launched here about Ukraine's membership and what's next in terms of its integrating into the Western European Defense Alliance is going to be crucial in the next few months about where things go next for Ukraine. We've also got a peace summit coming up soon in Switzerland as well. So this kind of global perspective on Ukraine is gathering pace as a topic here, particularly as Ukraine is losing, or not losing, but things are not going particularly well in the northeast of the country. So I think that's significant. Also, we heard from the Taiwanese president and the incoming Taiwanese leader there. Again, a lot about disinformation about how Taiwan is trying and has successfully countered outside interference in its own election process. Obviously, a big election there earlier this year. So Taiwan has got a big presence here. Armenia as well. The Armenian prime minister is here. He faced some protests, though, because there have been arrests in the Armenian capital just this week, in fact, with democracy activists protesting, calling for his resignation about a peace deal he is getting into with Azerbaijan. So, you know, around the fringes, even though it's about democracy, we can see that in some of these countries that are represented here, in their own domestic situation, things are not all rosy. And we're seeing that bit of dissent here on the fringes too.
Mm. And finally, what's on the agenda today?
Well, today we're going to hear a lot about tech and efforts to try and use tech, AI, generative AI as a force for good in democracies. Obviously, we know a lot about the malevolent use of this kind of technological advances and development, particularly in the field of AI, and how that can impact electoral systems, essentially. So instead, today, we're going to hear from a lot of young tech entrepreneurs from countries like Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia, Armenia. And we'll also hear from some Taiwanese officials. And we're going to have an address by the former Finnish Prime Minister, Sanna Marin. Again, she's actually going to be talking around this area of democracy and technology and freedom. There will be an address by her later on this morning.
Suzanne, thank you very much indeed. That's Suzanne Lynch there. And you're with Monocle Radio. Now, there are several ways cities can improve quality of life, from investing in housing, expanding transit networks, and prioritising green areas. One other way is by creating innovation districts, a neighbourhood that promotes creativity and research, creates jobs, and is thought out from start to finish. So how can municipalities harness the potential of them and use them to improve their urban environments? Well, that's one of the aims of the Global Institute on Innovation Districts. Earlier, its founder and president, Julie Wagner, stopped by our studios and she told Monocle's Tom Webb what innovation districts are all about.
An innovation district is a geography of innovation. It's located predominantly in urban and urbanizing cities. And it's the counterpart to a lot of the science parks and technology parks that you often see outside of cities and suburban areas that are accessible only by car, and very few people can reach these places. Innovation districts are a new and evolving model that is built on accessibility and density and things like porosity, which people in planning would love to know. But they are generally in the midtown and downtowns of cities, and they're anchored by R&D universities and medical institutions that are thinking about how to solve some of the most wicked problems that we have on this planet, but are realizing that they need the help of others. So the basis of the work is really collaborative innovation. And what struck me about this work is that the collaborative innovation actually means that the physical, the buildings, the streets, the parks, start to transform into a living lab once you start to understand that by placing startups and scale-ups and companies near these places and find unique ways for them to come together, these places start to change and become these centers of both discovery and delivery. As someone that has really moved in many different kinds of work, different fields of work, this really is a fascinating evolution that's happening in cities around the world.
And this evolution, can we say that it's been prompted by the pandemic that has given us an opportunity to revisit the way we look at cities?
Well, we found this phenomenon actually 15 years ago. It was built on a series of macro trends, such as the joint nature of innovation, the growing open innovation phenomenon, the growth and the proliferation of highly complex technologies, and frankly, the evolution of very strong, sort of small, more nimble companies that had the kinds of strengths that a lot of the large companies and the nimbleness that a lot of the larger companies didn't have. So they started to rewrite the code, basically, of what it meant to be competitive in an increasingly competitive world. But you asked about the pandemic, and during the pandemic, I actually received a lot of emails around our innovation districts dead. We're talking about physical proximity, we're talking about face-to-face, and yet we are collapsing back into our homes. It was an interesting time, and what we had discovered are the following. One, many of these districts have innovation infrastructure, core labs, very expensive technologies that you simply cannot recreate in your living room. These pulled researchers and other workers back in, not every day, but they pulled them in a significant amount. Two, the fact that a number of these places are organized, we're trying to think through how do we make sure they stay magnetic and create different kinds of programs to pull people back in. So while some of those more traditional downtowns were really struggling, these districts were trying to reinvent themselves even in the midst of the pandemic. It's fascinating to watch. And this is when I actually realized that some of the innovation behind innovation districts are the people that are looking across and trying to figure out how to orchestrate this type of ecosystem.
If you look at issues with inefficient land, how to create more jobs, but also investing in research as well, how can that address those issues?
I've spent a lot of time thinking about these sort of what sort of seem like fragments of challenges. And in the end of the day, what ultimately it comes down to is how these places are organized. And so I've really spent the last 2 to 3 years dedicating my research time focusing on how districts create different governance structures to be looking at these issues at the same time. Because it really does feel like you're playing three-dimensional chess. There's a lot of different things happening at the same time. So how do you sequence the work and pull in the right kinds of actors at the right time? This is very complex, and it requires a more intentional way of working.
We're going to turn now to the organization where you're president and founder, the Global Institute on Innovation, districts. Can you tell us more about the philosophy of what you do?
Yes. So we're a not-for-profit. We are a research organization, but we are focused on applied research, helping districts advance. So we have three arms of our work. We have one arm which is really focused on empirical research to make sure that districts are making strong, sound decisions on where to invest. We have a global network where we offer this kind of empirical research, but also safe support. And then we provide strategic support when these places are just struggling and needing to have some one-on-one time. So we do these three things with a mission to ensure that districts become a multiplier of growth, to really provide opportunities for a greater diversity of people and take on these wicked challenges.
So how do these challenges present themselves to you? What does the process look like? Do cities approach you first to get an innovation district qualification, or do you help local authorities develop the vision for these areas yourself?
I generally find they come to us. They find us because we write and we share a lot of our insights that we think are both empirically grounded and very sensitive to the changing macroeconomic and global forces. So we're often approached by national governments, state governments, city governments. We're approached by universities and medical institutions. We're approached by forward-thinking developers that have a long-term view. And they all come to us with different questions, with different starting points, but with the aim of how do we turn this idea actually into a true manifestation where we are becoming that multiplier of growth? How do we begin?
Julia Wagner there, president and founder of the Global Institute on Innovation Districts, speaking to Tom Webb. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Time to talk business now with Rachel Papazzoni, national business reporter and presenter at ABC News. She joins us from Perth. Good morning to you, or good afternoon to you, Rachel. Let's start with a US inflation data. That's going to be released later today. What are you expecting?
Yeah, and interestingly, Georgina, for most of this year, it's come in much hotter than economists had expected. So eyes will be closely scrutinising the numbers as they come in later today, local time, or while I'm sleeping later tonight. So this is a very important test of data that will come through. The expectation that is that it will show annualised inflation at 3.4%. And the reason why we're so keen to see what this number will show us is that with each month that has passed so far this year and the number coming in higher than expected, that has directly pushed back expectations for a rate cut from the US Fed, with some speculation as well about whether we would actually see rate hikes from the central bank. Now, the federal chairman, Jerome Powell, has downplayed any potential risk of a rate hike this year. But obviously, after several months of hotter than expected inflation, some analysts and market watchers will be nervous. At the start of this year, we were expecting 150 basis points of rate cuts through 2024. That's now down to about 40 basis points of monetary policy policy easing. And this is obviously putting a lot of pressure on borrowers, on people with loans, on Americans in general, and globally, central banks where I am, where you are, all around the world are closely watching to see what the US Fed does and whether it'll be the first mover or not, and how we all follow that. So important piece of data tonight.
Now, let's have a look at the UK mining giant Anglo American. It says that it is rejecting a bill from the Australian company BHP, but also that it's going to sell some of its assets.
Yeah, this is quite an interesting story that seems to develop every day. BHP putting in an increased offer for Anglo American at the start of this week, and then Anglo American rejecting that second increased offer, which valued Anglo American at $64 billion US dollars. Anglo American now determining it will divest the company and sell off part of it and essentially get rid of those less economical parts of the business. And from a domestic point of view, where I sit, that includes five coking coal mines in Queensland. And this is interesting because we've actually seen BHP and Rio Tinto do very similar things in the last few years, where they've sold off the less sort of money-making and less environmentally friendly and therefore less popular parts of their business and really focused down and drilled down on the most profitable parts of the business. Anglo American says that by doing this, that they'll lower their global costs by 1.7 billion US dollars, but it also does raise questions as to where that leaves BHP and its tilt at trying to acquire some of Anglo's assets.
And this affects the economy in Southern Africa, two huge diamond mines, of course, in Botswana, and that's De Beers, which is part of the business that they're considering selling.
That's right. So De Beers, obviously the biggest diamond business in the world, owned by Anglo American. And that was one of the sides of the business that BHP was not interested in. And part of BHP's initial takeover bid included the sale of a number of assets, including De Beers, including its iron ore business in South Africa. At this stage, Anglo American's plan would sell De Beers but keep the iron ore assets in South Africa. So there's, I think, a lot more to run on this. And what's interesting as well, Georgina, is that BHP has about another week before UK rules allow them to make that final bid for Anglo American. So I suspect there might be more developments in this story.
Now, in a moment, we're going to look at the South Korean music industry. Let's look now, though, first at Sony, because it appeared shares were down yesterday. Big jump, 12% for Sony shares today. What's going on?
Yeah. Huge jump, and that's because Sony announced today that it will pledge to boost shareholder returns. It'll take some time to do that, but it's promised to gradually increase dividends with a target of 40% of total payout ratio by the end of the financial year in 2027. It's also announced a big share buyback scheme today, worth 1.6 billion US dollars or 250 billion yen. And this obviously comes off the back of some pretty poor numbers for the company. It's also talking about expectations for its PlayStation 5 sales to be about 18 million units this year. And it's acknowledged that it's really overhauling that side of the business to make that more profitable, different lines of reporting and executives overseeing it. And it's also reportedly rethinking its bid for Paramount. It's in a conglomerate, reportedly interested in buying Paramount with another firm, Apollo Global Management. So I guess, like what we're seeing with Anglo American, a real sort of stock take of where Sony is and the best way to make it a profitable business into the future.
Rachel, thank you very much indeed. That's Rachel Papazzoni there in Perth. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio. Now, you'll have heard of BTS, the insanely popular K-pop group. It's on hiatus right now as its members complete their mandatory military service. But it has made the company behind it, HYBE, huge amounts of money, a profit now threatened by the producer of New Jeans from the same stable and arguably today's hottest K-pop act, who's gone public over her dispute with the parent company. Well, Bernie Cho is president of the Seoul-based K-pop agency DFSB Collective. He's joining us now from Los Angeles. Bernie, many thanks for coming on the show. I wonder if you could tell us what this scandal's all about. Let's begin, for listeners not familiar, with who HYBE and NewJeans are.
Okay, let's take a step back before we move forward. But HYBE is arguably probably the fourth largest music company in the world. You know, we talk about Universal Music, Warner Music, and just now Sony Music. If we look at pure revenues annually, HYBE is arguably the fourth largest music company in the world. Just in February, I mean, they were very much on a for-the-win momentum track. The IFPI showed that they had three of the top 10 music artists in the world, number 217, number 7 TXT, and number 8 NewJeans. And again, if we looked at HYBE as a music label, they had 40% of the top 20 best-selling albums in the world last year. So they're huge, they're massive, they're definitely living up to the hype. Now, at that time, HYBE was going to become the first Korean entertainment company on KOSDAQ, the Korean Stock Exchange, to be listed and to be categorized and, more importantly, classified as a conglomerate. That's how much revenue they were pulling in, multi-billion dollars in revenue. Just as they were about to hit this peak, as they were about to hit this height, on April 21st, suddenly out of nowhere, HYBE shockingly announced and, more importantly, demanded that the CEO of their hottest group at the moment, NewJeans, the CEO of Adore, which is the sub-label that was producing NewJeans, they wanted the creative genius, that CEO, Min Hee Jin, to immediately resign. That stunned the industry. And the allegations were incredibly serious, even salacious, but definitely scandalous. They accused Min Hee Jin of an attempted management control coup, and they immediately raided the offices and audited the Adore CEO as well as the board of directors. And they accused her and her team of leaking contracts, trade secrets, personal information, and more importantly, that they were seeking outside consultations to go independent. And as a result of this sudden raid, the value from April 21st to as of today, the value of HYBE stock has dropped nearly 20%. And to put that into perspective, that's over 1.2 trillion Korean won, or nearly $1 billion. Wow.
Bernie, can I just ask you, does this devalue the whole concept of Hallyu, cultural influence?
Well, what's really fascinating and interesting is not one, not two, not many, but pretty much all of the top Korean entertainment companies, whether they be TV production companies, film studios, but more importantly, music companies, are all publicly traded on the Korean Stock Exchange. And as a whole, the entertainment industry, the media industry, the pop culture industry, it is the second largest pop consumer goods export out of Korea. And because all of these companies are publicly traded, they're very much held to a very high standard in terms of financial transparency, but more importantly, accuracy. Now, HYBE has touted and really pioneered this idea of a multi-label concept in Korea. And for all intents and purposes, it was really looked at as a case study of success. Now it has quickly become a cautionary tale of what could possibly maybe go wrong or worse off the rails. And so a lot of people have been watching closely, not only the dirty details of the dirty laundry being aired, but more importantly, a lot of lawyers to financial analysts are really studying closely sort of how this even came about, because there is a lot of corporate intrigue, espionage, and complexity involved. And so as a publicly traded company, people want to know, how were these subsidiaries set up so that it thinks something like this could, you know, explode and implode and really just put, you know, the whole industry in sort of a dampened mode?
Bernie Cho, thank you very much for joining us here on The Globalist. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producers, Vincent McAvinney, Carlotta Ribello and Monica Lillis. Our researcher, George Ruskin, and our studio manager, Lily Austin. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday in London, and I'll return on The Globalist at the same time tomorrow. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.